Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature a presentation by John Anderson, graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, entitled God Casting on the March, Spectrum Speculation via FM Translator Station. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This was a watershed week for media reform, with three important bills being passed by key congressional committees and a raucous rally and hearing at the Federal Communications Commission. Tuesday, the Senate Commerce Committee advanced the bipartisan Local Community Radio Act, which could help bring hundreds of local low-power FM radio stations to cities and suburbs across the country. A companion bill awaits action in the House. The Senate Commerce Committee also approved the bipartisan Community Broadband Act. This bill would overturn state prohibitions against cities and towns providing their own high-speed internet services. It promises to bring faster, cheaper, and more reliable broadband services to local communities that now find themselves on the wrong side of the digital divide. And in the House, the Energy and Commerce Committee passed the Broadband Census of America Act. Currently, there are no reliable numbers to measure high-speed internet access and availability in the United States, which has been falling behind the rest of the world. The bill would require both the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the FCC to collect more and more accurate information. And to punctuate the week, on Halloween, hundreds of citizens rallied at FCC headquarters to send a message to big media and FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. The agency held its final localism hearing with only a few days' advance notice. Yet civil rights and labor leaders, consumer and media reform advocates, and a team of cheerleaders showed up to speak out against more media consolidation. Media Minutes will have more highlights from the event next week.
Media consolidation has had a detrimental effect on children's television programming, according to new research by Children Now, a California-based advocacy group focused on making children a top priority in public policy. Quality educational programming is beneficial to children, says Christy Globke, director of the group's Children in the Media program and author of the study Big Media, Little Kids 2. Globke says programs like Sesame Street can help young kids prepare for kindergarten, and the effects can last through high school.
For those students who may be more at a disadvantage, may not have access to quality preschool or access to a lot of books in their homes, it actually helps level the playing field for them.
The Big Media Little Kids 2 study looked at the effect of duopolies, those markets where one company owns two stations. They chose eight various-sized markets, such as Chicago and El Paso, and compared programming in 2 years, 1998, before the duopolies were permitted, and 2006.
If you look at the hours of children's programming that was offered on the stations, duopolies decreased their programs over that time period, the hours of programming by four times more than non-duopoly stations. And if you look at the number of series that were offered to kids, they decreased their programming by five times more than non-duopoly stations. So they were big decreases.
Broadcasters are reluctant to air children's programming because it isn't as lucrative as adult or sports programming. In 1996, Congress and the FCC required them to air at least 3 hours of children's educational programming per week. But broadcasters say that if kids are watching programming on cable, why should they have to air programming on broadcast channels? Globke has a couple of answers for them.
About 15% of kids don't have access to cable or satellite television. All they have is access to commercial broadcast television. The other part of it is that broadcasters are using a valuable public resource, the public airwaves, for free. They aren't paying for it. And because they use it for free, they need to give something back to the communities that they serve. And one of the very few ways that have been identified that require them to serve the public is children's educational programming.
Globke hopes the study will help policymakers understand the need for quality children's programming on broadcast stations. She says children's media advocacy isn't just about keeping bad media away from kids. It's really about helping to create good media that can benefit children. For more information about the study, go to childrennow.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Barack Obama is engaged in a high-profile, low-substance effort to distance himself from Hillary Clinton on the Iraq War. It's like watching Siamese twins slap each other around, knowing that the two are genetically identical and inseparable. Clinton and Obama are conjoined war Democrats who pretend to disagree on a phrase here and there. Both intend to stay in Iraq as long as so-called U.S. interests dictate. In that regard, their shared Iraq position is no different than George Bush's stated goals. Last week, the New York Times gave Obama acres of space to spin his illusory Iraq withdrawal plan. More space than the newspaper has afforded Dennis Kucinich, the real peace candidate, during the whole primary campaign. It was a waste of words, see-through clothing on a naked body. Obama claims he doesn't plan to maintain permanent bases in Iraq. So, by the way, do Hillary Clinton and George Bush. But Obama says he'll employ a broader strategic approach than Clinton, that he won't shy away from talking directly to the leaders of Iran and Syria. Senator Clinton says she'd have to study the matter a while before deciding whether to have face-to-face meetings. But meetings about what? Obama and Clinton both insist that the U.S. military reserves the right to remain in Iraq until it serves U.S. interests to do otherwise. In Obama's words, until we see some stability in the region. But what is stability? Apparently, it means pacification, just as it did in Vietnam. The withdrawal of which Obama speaks is predicated on leaving behind secure areas, again, in his words, so we can afford to remove troops. And that depends on getting the cooperation of the Iraqis, friend and foe alike. George Bush sings the same song. When Iraqis stand up, we stand down, says Bush, bringing back an oldie but goldie phrase that Presidents Johnson and Nixon deployed endlessly in Southeast Asia two generations ago. Obama assured the New York Times that he doesn't intend to stay in Iraq for another 10 or 20 years. That is, if those pesky Iraqis just act right. If they don't, all bets are off. Here's a definitive quote from the candidate. I will remove all our combat troops. We will have those troops there to protect our embassies and our civilian forces, and we will engage in counterterrorism activities, said Obama. However, he continues, how large that force is, whether it's located inside Iraq or as an over-the-horizon force, is going to depend on what our military situation is. In other words, Iraq will have to be pacified for Obama's 14 to 15 month piecemeal and totally iffy withdrawal to take place. Hillary Clinton won't even mention anything smacking of a timetable, but that doesn't really make a difference, since Obama's schedule depends on achievement of some kind of U.S. victory before withdrawal, which is George Bush's stated scenario as well. Like Bush and Clinton, Obama refuses to take any military options off the table, including nuclear options. Although Obama is less rhetorically bullying than Bush and more charming than Clinton, all three reserve the right to launch a first strike against Iran. This is the language of war criminals. It seems our problem is not the Siamese twins, Obama and Clinton, but Siamese triplets, Hillary, Barack, and Bush. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a presentation by John Anderson, graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, entitled Godcasting on the March, Spectrum Speculation via FM Translator Station. The following presentation was recorded on Friday, October 26, 2007, at the 2007 conference of the UDC, the Union for Democratic Communications, held at Simon Fraser University in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
My name is John Anderson. I'm with the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I'm going to be presenting a homily of investigative journalism more than a specific academic theoretical story for you today. So if you would all open your Gospels to U.S. Broadcast Policy, Book of John, Chapter 1, Verse 1, let us pray. Not all radio stations are equal. Some classes of broadcast station are designed by regulation to play supplementary roles to others. A specific example of this type of radio station is the FM translator, which was originally intended to supplement the coverage of existing full-power FM radio stations. However, within the last 25 years, important changes have been made to Federal Communications Commission regulations regarding the use of translator stations. By and large, religious broadcasters have exploited these changes to build regional and national media ministries for a fraction of the cost of a comparable network of full-power radio stations. First, some history. The FCC first created the FM translator service in 1970. Its primary goal was defined as assisting FM stations in terrain-challenged areas to provide more thorough coverage via simulcasts on a second FM signal. Initially, all translators had to be fed directly by the signal from a full-power parent or primary radio station. In order to further emphasize their secondary distinction, FM translators were saddled with a bevy of operating restrictions. These included a cap on the maximum operating power, initially 10 watts, later hiked to 250 watts, and a blanket prohibition on the origination of local programming. Translators were also limited to operation on just 40 of the 100 existing FM channels. In 1981, the Moody Bible Institute, a Chicago-based seminary with a long history of evangelistic outreach via broadcasting, petitioned the FCC for a rule change allowing non-commercial users of translator stations to feed them with a program source other than another local FM signal. The FCC denied the petition in 1984. One of the reasons it gave for doing so was the behavior of some parties who have filed a large number of translator applications for many locations and population centers that, if granted, would virtually preclude other spectrum users. The commission also noted an emerging pattern or use of FM translators to extend the service areas of existing FM stations rather than to fill in areas of inadequate direct reception. However, 4 years later, in 1988, the FCC did approve a rule change which allowed non-commercial translators to be fed via microwave or satellite under certain limited conditions. Then in 1990, the FCC released yet another report and order, which constituted a significant overhaul of the translator rules in a variety of ways. It introduced a new concept for allowing FM translators to operate outside the bounds of a primary station's service area, effectively unchaining them from full-power stations altogether, though they were still prohibited from originating local programming. Additionally, non-commercial translators were authorized to operate on any channel in the FM band. It is interesting to note that it was during this period, 1984 to 1990, that many religious broadcasters, which today rely on networks of FM translators, were founded. Don Wildman, founder of the American Family Association, received a vision from God to evangelize using a network of FM translator stations in 1987. The American Family Association now holds the licenses to more than 200 radio stations, the majority of which are translators. Similarly, the Educational Media Foundation, parent organization to the K-Love and Air One Christian Music Networks, was founded in 1986 and today can be heard on hundreds of FM signals nationwide, including more than 350 translator stations. In 1997, the FCC froze the filing of new applications for FM translators on the majority of the FM dial. That application freeze was still in place in the year 2000, when the FCC created a new low-power FM community radio service. Whereas translators broadcast with up to 250 watts, LPFM stations, as they are known, are limited to just 100 watts. While translators are forbidden from creating their own programming, LPFM stations are encouraged to be live and local. However, LPFM stations occupy a somewhat compromised position relative to translators. Although LPFMs are required to prevent interference to translators, the protection is not reciprocal. As another form of low-power radio service, LPFM stations effectively compete with translators for available openings on the FM spectrum. The FCC accepted an inaugural round of LPFM station license applications starting in mid-2000. Of more than 3,000 applications filed, some 800 fully licensed LPFM stations are now on the air, and about another 200 are currently under construction. Following this singular opportunity for the creation of new LPFM radio stations, the FCC opened up a window for the filing of new FM translators in 2003. A large pent-up demand awaited this window. Not only had the FCC effectively frozen the growth of translator stations for nearly 6 years running, but it had awarded valuable spectrum that might have otherwise been used for translators to LPFM stations in the interim. During the five-day application filing window for new FM translator stations in 2003, the agency received more than 13,000 applications. Now, to put that figure in some perspective, had the FCC approved them all, it would have effectively doubled the number of licensed radio stations in the United States overnight. Of all the applications filed, however, 15 groups accounted for more than half of them. This included the Educational Media Foundation, which tendered nearly 900, and various Calvary Chapel-affiliated churches, which filed more than 400. However, the largest crush of FM translator applications, nearly one-third of the total, more than 4,000, came from two heretofore unknown groups called Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting. Remember those names, we'll be talking about them in detail. It would seem that the latter two groups had been created for the specific purpose of taking advantage of the FM translator application window. According to the Idaho Secretary of State, Radio Assist Ministry was incorporated in late 2002 and Edgewater Broadcasting in 2003. The company's listed address is a P.O. box in Twin Falls, Idaho. Radio Assist Ministry shares the same corporate executives, most significantly a president by the name of Clark Parrish, whom we will also discuss later. There is a third corporation, World Radio Link, with an identical address and executive board. Although it did not apply for any FM translator licenses in 2003, World Radio Link does hold at least 28 full-power AM and FM radio station construction permits in various locales around the country. Now, it's important to note that none of these three companies actually own or operate a significant number of radio stations. Among them, they've collected, in essence, government permission to build radio stations in various locations around the country. At least one of Radio Assist's, Edgewater's, and World Radio Link's board has prior connections to religious broadcasting and intimate knowledge of constructing a national religious broadcast network via the use of translator stations. In just 4 years, between 1993 and 1997, until the FCC froze new translator station applications, the Calvary Satellite Network went from one FM station in Twin Falls, Idaho, to a broadcast chain of more than 400 stations nationwide, the majority of which are translators. Clark Parrish was CSN's chief engineer, and he actively designed and constructed the technical growth of that network. According to CSN's program director, Don Mills, Parrish left the operation to found his corporate triad. Evidence also exists that Radio Assist Ministry, Edgewater Broadcasting, and World Radio Link were set up specifically to traffic in permits to build radio stations. Now, trade in spectrum for financial gain is not really all that new. Broadcast spectrum, much like real estate, can be bought, sold, and traded between those who have obtained prior permission to develop it, and the FCC rarely intercedes. The very notion that permission must be obtained and that only a limited number of users can be accommodated helps give spectrum its value. But Radio Assist Ministry, Edgewater Broadcasting, and World Radio Link sought to sell the rights to spectrum even before they had those rights in hand. Furthermore, the degree to which the corporate triad organized its trafficking scheme is somewhat unprecedented. Construction permits to build FM translator stations have typically not been bought, sold, or traded like full power station construction permits have in the past. In this sense, Radio Assist, Edgewater, and World Radio Link sought to extend the marketplace for broadcast spectrum to the translator level. Obviously, a construction permit for a 250-watt FM translator station will not fetch nearly the same price as a permit to build a 100,000-watt full-power FM radio station, but the ability to deal in volume certainly presents the potential of a promising payday. In 2004, as the FCC worked its way through the flood of translator applications filed the year before, a man by the name of Steve Atkin attended the National Religious Broadcasters annual convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, Atkin identified himself as working for Radio Assist Ministry. He actively solicited customers for FM translator construction permits that had not yet been issued, but for which Radio Assist had applied. At the NRB 2005 annual convention in Anaheim, California, World Radio Link was one of the exhibitors. As of February 2005, of the 4,221 FM translator applications filed by the Radio Assist and Edgewater corporate duo, 1,026 were granted construction permits by the FCC, 853 were dismissed, and 2,342 were pending. The Radio Assist Edgewater business plan appears to be a lucrative one. Given the record of transactions involving translator construction permits the duo has received, although they paid nothing to apply for the FM translator stations. An examination of just a fraction of the construction permits the company has sold shows they've already booked more than $1.2 million in sales. In general terms, interested Godcasters pay a fraction of the purchase price for a translator station up front as an option payment, in essence, for the construction permit when Radio Assist Ministry or Edgewater gets it. They pay another installment when the FCC officially awards the permits to Radio Assist or Edgewater, and then they pay the balance due on that construction permit once the permit is actually transferred from speculator to final owner. Given that the sale of just a fraction of the translator construction permits held by Radio Assist and Edgewater has netted more than $1 million, a conservative average valuation of the remaining permits held by the companies is $5.6 million. If just half of Radio Assist and Edgewater's outstanding translator applications were to be granted construction permits, the average value of its holdings would effectively double. This is just but one highlight of the speculation and trafficking that's taken place in translator station construction permits. Additionally, Radio Assist and Edgewater also seem to have been engaged in the free trade of translator construction permits with other established religious broadcasters like American Family Radio. More research is needed to determine whether religious broadcast interests are colluding on a large scale to consolidate their holdings of translator stations, and in many instances, they already rebroadcast each other's programming, further muddying the waters with regard to just which entities own what stations. The FCC does seem to notice that something not right is going on. In March of 2005, it imposed a temporary freeze on all pending FM translator applications. However, it does admit that a good chunk of spectrum has already left the barn, and now I will quote, the Media Bureau's audio division already has granted approximately 3,300 new translator station construction permits, a number nearly equal to the total number of FM translator stations licensed and operating prior to the 2003 filing window. These are frequencies which otherwise might have been used for bona fide live and local LPFM community radio stations. Inexplicably, however, transactions related to the 2003 translator application flood continue to be processed in apparent violation of the agency's own determinations. Several religious broadcast magnates have made their own personal pilgrimages to FCC headquarters in Washington, D.C., where they've lobbied Chairman Kevin Martin and senior staff to allow this practice to continue. Over the course of time, incremental rule changes have been made by the FCC involving the placement and use of FM translator stations. In the process, FM translators have been transformed from a wholly secondary type of broadcast service into a low-cost alternative to full-power broadcast networking. The FCC should reevaluate its regulations governing the proper use of FM translator stations and take a firm position on whether or not they are actually primary or secondary providers of service. Failure of the FCC to completely come to terms with and overcome this particular regulatory vulnerability undermines principles it has declared sacrosanct: historically, public interest, convenience, and necessity, and contemporarily, localism in part, embodied through the promulgation of the LPFM service. Frankly, it is hypocritical for the FCC to create an opportunity to expand truly local community broadcasting one year and then effectively strangle it by flooding the FM spectrum with more occupants a few years later. The FCC's inability to properly police the allocation of spectrum to prevent speculation and trafficking, and its follow-on failure to follow its own determinations once evidence of a problem came to light, further demonstrates the agency's abrogation of regulation of the public airwaves in the public interest. In conclusion, it is important to note that the behaviors detailed herein are not representative of all religious broadcasters. But the fact that such chicanery is taking place in the name of God is deeply disturbing in its own right. Nor should any of this be read as an attack on the right of religious broadcasters to access the airwaves. The primary concern here is content neutral. Whether or not the public interest is adequately served by entities that trade in public spectrum designed for non-commercial purposes at the expense of other no less qualified potential users. In a nutshell, this is a scandal, the depths of which may not be fully known for years to come. Amen.
That was a presentation by John Anderson, graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who gave a presentation on October 26, 2007 in Vancouver, Canada. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.